مالا شمول دنیا قوی بلی ور دوال خوی شیبایت بنیا توی
آم شمول شمول شمول
نداد زر دیو بابا گفت نبیزن بول چاوا در اولو رجو آوا
آم شمول شمول شمول
خد قلم را و سرات دو جلو کت فارات ایده بس قدرات
آخ شمو شمو شمو
قایل نده و به گندا من درد ریاد بندا یار مشنا و هتل بیشندا
آخ شمو شمو شمو
alayaka kai sikale sagoi kale raka ala holi lake kale yaka kai sikale sagoi kale raka
مالیا مم مزره مم مک مم مک مم مو چاره خیر نگه دار فره
پزدا خسر چیمو
چاره خیر نگه دار فره
پزدا خسر چیمو
دسته یک می پز بکر
مم مک مم مک مم مو
لب لنگا تکره
پزدا خسر چیمو
لب لنگا تکره
پزدا خسر چیمو
خسرو خنزور ممک ممک ممو تورتش زرر که بور
پزدا خسر چمو
تورتش زرر که بور
پزدا خسر چمو
جاری هر کبر
ممک ممک ممو
جاری هر نالا کور
پزدا خسر چمو
جاری هر نالا کور
پزدا خسر چمو
çek bir civanem, çabuk ile sifanem. Mecin ziran ve kreyhan, ketime deste biyan. Mecin ziran ve kreyhan, ketime deste biyan. Serimin girdana, dünyanın bende hana. Serimin girdana, dünyanın bende hana. Ne hazım var bilmedin, evinde ara kurdana. Ne hazım var bilmedin, evinde ara kurdana.
We'll be right back. ونسبح في لجاجة مقطرينا خلفت الظن وانت لي ما ظن خسارة 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 ما مضى واصبح دفينا
أنا والنيل الليل دنا ودين اللي بعلاتة حزينة صبرت وكان الصبر ظن على هامش نسير العاشقين أنا والنيل الليل تنى ونيل اللي بعلاتة حزينة صبرت وكان الصبر ظنى على هامش نسير العاشقين
Thank you. Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Metamorphosis and Other Stories by Franz Kafka, translated by Joachim Neugreschel and narrated by George Guidel. This work, copyrighted 1993 and 1995 by Joachim Neugreschel, is recorded by arrangement with Georges Borchardt Incorporated. This recording is copyrighted 1995 by Recorded Books Incorporated. And now, The Metamorphosis and Other Stories.
Introduction. On-site migration. Our grandparents spoke Yiddish, our parents spoke German, and those of us who are left speak Czech. That statement by a Prague Jew sums up the linguistic and cultural history of not only the Prague Jews, but, by extension, the vast majority of European Jews since the end of the 18th century. During this period, the various Jewish communities in Europe and its colonies have passed from Jewish languages to a few simultaneous and/or sequential non-Jewish languages, and perhaps ultimately back, or forward, to Hebrew in Israel. Outside Israel, this process has shifted the Jews from an ethnic category with a core religion and multiple Jewish subcultures, Ashkenazi, Sephardic, etc., to a religious category whose various communities are scattered through many countries, where they are largely assimilating into the local non-Jewish cultures. Franz Kafka was born in Prague at the end of the 19th century, and for most of his lifetime, Bohemia and Moravia belonged to Austria-Hungary, until 1919, 5 years before Kafka's death in 1924. During that era, the Jews in Prague, like many Jews within the dual monarchy and most Jews in the German Empire, were discarding Yiddish in favor of German, the language of the dominant culture, while holding on to their own religious practices and identities. Parallel developments were taking place wherever Jews were, in fact, allowed to assimilate into the language and culture, especially throughout Western Europe, but far less so in the Tsarist Empire. This process of what I would like to call reacculturation began when Napoleon offered French citizenship, nationality, and complete civil rights to the Jews in France. They would thereby become French Jews if they agreed to give up their own Jewish culture and languages, their peoplehood, and maintain only their religious identity. They agreed, under great pressure, thus abandoning some centuries-old Jewish languages and cultures in France. Judith, Judeo-Provençal, Western Laz, Judeo-French, and Alsatian Yiddish. Western Laz, incidentally, had helped to provide the substratum of Yiddish during its birth phase in Alsace-Lorraine. In the 19th and 20th centuries, new generations of Central and West European Jews spoke a Jewish tongue with their parents, but a non-Jewish one with each other, and of course with Christians. When Karl Marx or Heinrich Heine wrote to their parents, their letters, still extant, were in Western Yiddish, misnomered Judendeutsch in German. Much later, Bernard Berenson wrote an article about his childhood experiences with Yiddish and its literature, which, however, like many assimilated Jews, he dismissed as irrelevant. Elias Canetti, in his memoirs, The Tongue Set Free, describes his Sephardic family in their native Sofia and the Ladino they spoke, which, however, he eventually replaced with German. And Primo Levi, in his autobiographical collection, The Periodic Table, touches on the Judeo-Italian language used by his family and the local Jewish community. Those are better-known exemplars of the countless Jews whose families passed from Jewish to non-Jewish in language and society, thus becoming, perhaps unwittingly, a transitional minority. Such on-site migration paralleled the mass migrations of Jews, especially from Eastern to Western Europe and then to the New World. Franz Kafka was a member of the on-site migration, while Karl Rossmann in The Stoker, America, acts out the geographic migration. Language in modern Europe became a defining national and then political characteristic, especially with the emergence of the nation-states in the 19th century. A natural, i.e. biological, rationale was supplied by Darwin, for whom language, and English in particular, was a sign of higher evolution. When describing some aborigines whom he brought back to London in The Origin of Species, he explains that the ones who managed to pick up some English were obviously the more highly evolved in the group. Such thinking pervades all modern politicizing of language, especially imperialism, not to mention on-site imperialism. By giving up their own language and assimilating to the surrounding languages, Jews became more acceptable to their host nations and to themselves, both socially and civically, and economically. Internally, however, religious Jews looked forward to the coming of the Messiah and or a return to Palestine, and thus saw their given Jewish language as part of a transitional condition. Then again, many Jews regarded their Jewish language as culturally inferior to either Hebrew or a non-Jewish tongue, especially the national administrative language of a country. For Jews throughout Central and Eastern Europe, German was the language of enlightenment, civilization, modernity. For Kafka, language is likewise viewed, sardonically, as the hallmark of being human. When Gregor Samsa is turned into an insect, his speech can barely be understood, and the family members act as if he cannot understand them. Only the uneducated housekeeper addresses him directly, though teasing him. The ape, in A Report to an Academy, takes his first step toward becoming a human being by saying, "Hey!" This makes him virtually the embodiment of the assimilating Jew. Kafka satirized the European attitude toward language, yet employed language as his foremost instrument. Born in the multilingual Austro-Hungarian city of Prague, the site of the first German university, Franz Kafka was raised and schooled in German in his assimilating Jewish family, although unlike most Prague Germans, Gentiles or Jews, he was somewhat fluent in Czech. Kafka made wondrous use of Prague German, which itself became a transitional tongue in the Czechoslovakian capital. The Nazi regime, banning Kafka and murdering most of the Jewish speakers of Prague German, ultimately precipitated the expulsion of the Germans from Prague, thereby abolishing a very old and very rich area of German culture. As a result, Kafka's oeuvre has now become a monument to Prague German, which, like so many dialects and regional variants of German, was liquidated along with the fascist era. The language of these Prague Germans differed crucially from what was spoken in the German lands. Prague German was never fed by a local German dialect, which, perceptibly or not, infiltrates the speaking and writing of every German, even the most fastidious writer, down to the very forms, genders, syntax, stresses, and inflections. Surrounded by Czech, but by no German dialect, Prague German has been described, half derisively, as a holiday German, because, for better or worse, it lacks the slang, colloquialisms, and dialectal influences that color High German in most areas. Still, Prague German was lovingly influenced by the forms and phrases, the quirks and cadences of Austrian, especially Viennese German, that is, a regional standard usage but not a substandard dialect. More colloquial in their speech than they realized, the Prague Germans nevertheless saw their tongue as a pure linguistic and stylistic model that they used in their literature, which therefore sounds more colloquial than its authors sensed, just as their spoken language sounded more literary than that of most German speakers. "We write the way we speak," they said. Indeed they did, and they almost spoke the way they wrote. Kafka's prose, likewise, reveals a careful and lucid Prague German with an Austrian tinge. In his earliest stories, he tested certain expressionist and even surrealist innovations, shredding syntax, short-circuiting imagery, condensing emotions and tableau into brief, sometimes even tiny, shards and prose poems to evoke a moody and sometimes wistful lyricism that patched these various fragments into a world of jocular mystery. Ultimately, however, especially in his master tales, The Judgment and The Metamorphosis, he settled into a generally traditional language that paid scant homage to contemporary stylistic upheavals in German and French. Thus, less than 20 years before Kafka began writing, the interior monologue or stream of consciousness had been invented in French literature by a Belgian novelist, Edouard Dujardin, Les Lauriers sans Coupé, 1887, and in German literature by a Viennese Jew, Arthur Schnitzler, in his short story, Lieutenant Gustl, 1890. Ultimately reaching British literature and thriving in the fiction of James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, this innovation affected Kafka as little as most other modern linguistic experiments. Compared with the far more realistic contents of Joyce, Wolfe, and Schnitzler, the world of Kafka's writings is so bizarre, so alienated, so grotesque, that a both humorous and anguished incongruity arises from the juxtaposition of subject and style, absurdity and realism. Kafka's shock effects, and shock is a major component of modernism, were powerful enough in those times, and by sticking to an everyday, sometimes impartial prose that takes the nightmares for granted, he intensifies their overwhelming impact. Thus, in telling us that Gregor Samsa, whom we are supposed to know, wakes up to find himself turned into a giant bug, the author, commencing in medias res, like Arthur Rimbaud in The Drunken Boat, though not in the first person, reports in a cool, casual, objective tone that displays no surprise at this unnatural anti-miracle. However, the objectivity and matter-of-factness of the narrative voice are breached by a stylistic device that had a long tradition in European, especially Yiddish, literature. While commonly used in English, this device has no name here. We refer to it both by the French term, Stil indirect libre, and by the German term, erlebte Rede. Fusing the author's objective omniscience, third person, past tense, etc., with the character's innermost mental view, this device offers empathy in its older pre-Madison Avenue sense, a process of total mental and spiritual identification. Tomorrow was Sunday. The past tense was stakes off the narrator's viewpoint. The noun tomorrow evokes the character's viewpoint. Otherwise, the use of a past tense with tomorrow would be a logical discrepancy. By now, Stil indirect libre has become so overused in European languages as to be a flagrant symptom of pulp and kitsch. However, by skillfully exploiting this method, Kafka manages to lead us from poker-faced protocol to subjective angst, forming a bond between tragicomical protagonists and desperately smirking readers, only to alienate the characters even more, since the bond is unilateral. The persona can never leave the imaginary world and can therefore never link up with the real author and the real reader. Empathy becomes alienation. The sources of alienation in Kafka and in his characters, they're not necessarily identical with him, have been thoroughly investigated by scholars. His attempts at being universal are taken for granted. After all, literature, since Aristotle, has been seen, often purblindly, as a universal category. John Updike even praises Kafka for avoiding Jewish parochialism, The New Yorker, 1983. Although well-meaning and certainly sympathetic with Kafka's predicament as a Jew, Updike expresses the bias of the dominant culture, which takes itself for granted. It subliminally sees itself as universal and axiomatic, while viewing external and smaller cultures as parochial and relative. This prejudice likewise extends to the other, to colonized and marginalized groups like women and homosexuals, racial and religious minorities. Black writers like Willard Motley or Frank Yerby were not African-American authors. They mainly depicted whites. Female authors have been criticized for writing about women and then praised or castigated for writing like a man. Book reviewers, if no longer boycotting gay novels, will nevertheless chide them, as does the New York Times, for not including more heterosexual characters. When was the last time they attacked heterosexual fiction for not including more homosexuals, or accused Balzac or Proust of having too many French characters? In most countries, Jews have written about Jews when working in Jewish languages and about non-Jews in a non-Jewish language. Canada is a good example.